Alrighty, hello everyone and welcome back to the Reformed Dissenters. That is the show where Reformed Christians dissent against popular ideas of culture by asserting a biblical worldview. I'm Bruce Johnson, of course, joined by my brother Jacob Johnson.
Hello everybody.
And today we are talking on this Literature Friday about the book we've been talking about this whole month called Public Stoning, God's Design for a Nation Without Prisons by Mr. Adam Terrell, who we will actually be having on the show next week, so stay tuned for that. That's going to be our literature episode for next week. So, this is it. We're here. We are at the end of this book. We've covered every chapter in this book, 11 chapters now. This is our 11th chapter. It'll be a bit of a shorter episode because we only have one chapter, and we'll really be breaking down pretty much just the end of it. But there's lots to say, lots to discuss, and we'll be getting into this very shortly. Before we do that, though, we have to do what we always do, which is talk about our verse of the week. Almost said month. I don't know why. It's the verse of the week. Always has been for 3 years now. Bruce, get it straight. And to do that on Fridays, Jacob will be doing that. So take it away. I should stop talking now. This is getting worse.
Our verse this week is found in 1 Corinthians 15, verse 58. Chapter 15, verse 58. I said that right. I might.
Yeah.
And it says, Therefore, my beloved brothers, be steadfast, immovable, always abounding in the work of the Lord, knowing that in the Lord your labor is not in vain. And again, that was 1 Corinthians 15, verse 58. I had multiple things that I wanted to say about this, but I decided to, after hearing what Bruce said on Monday, sorry, not Monday, Wednesday,
it's not just me.
Yeah, I was in a sense inspired to go this route and talk about something just a little bit off of what this is, but still pertaining to this very topic stated in this verse. But speaking about this specifically, always abounding, always. Bruce brought up our verse on our show, and that is verse Matthew 5:13, right? Good.
Yep.
Yes. Matthew 5:13, which talks about us being the salt of the earth, the salt and light. And I was thinking about this light and the very fact that when the sun comes out, this light comes out, it shines through all the earth, and you see nothing but light. It's all light. But when the sun goes away, darkness comes back. The very fact that darkness is the absence of light. That darkness coming in, and we've throughout the Bible that the use of darkness is used to describe evil, is described to mean our sin, is described to mean the evil works of the world. And that light is shown to be God's light. God's light shown through Christians and believers. And so this very fact of these Christians, when they do not exist, when they do not push as they ought to, being salt and light in the world, this darkness is allowed to creep in. I found this quote by Edmund Burke. It's always, Bruce and I were discussing about the origins of this quote, but I will give it to Edmund Burke for this time being. Edmund Burke says, "The only thing necessary for the triumph of evil is that good men do nothing." End quote. And this speaks to the very fact of what we're talking about. Christians, if you do nothing in the world, evil will prevail. If you think we are supposed to sit back and relax and just watch as the world falls apart, it will fall apart. But if you do something, light will prevail. Light will come. And ultimately, I do not mean to say that that the world will fall apart, because it won't. Because we know it will end well. God will prevail in the end. But it will fall apart in your generation. It will fall down. It will crumble. This nation, America, will crumble. That's, at this point, almost inevitable. But we will prevail. Because knowing that in the Lord, our labor is not in vain. What we do, as long as it is for God and as long as it is following Scripture, we will prevail, and our work is not in vain. Mm. So by Christians doing something, darkness will fall back.
Amen. Yeah, brilliant, Jacob. Thank you so much for delving into that. It's a really good take on that passage. So moving into our study today, might be a bit of a shorter episode just because we're just talking about one chapter, chapter 11. And Mr. Terrell just called it further concepts. And there are a lot of further concepts in here. You know, this really sparked a conversation Jacob and I were having in the pre-show about when we're talking about specifically applying the judicial law of God today, we have to think through what that looks like. When we're talking about physically and literally applying the judicial law, we are not an agrarian society. This is a conversation we've had many, many times on the show. This is a conversation many other people have on lots of other shows and in lots of other books. And particularly, a group of people got together quite a while back, some sort of council or other, and produced something we now call the Westminster Confession of Faith. They use the term general equity to describe some of the things and concepts we're discussing. So we would call ourselves general equity theonomists, which basically is just a fancy way of saying the law of God, the principles behind the law of God, are good and right and just and reviving the soul. And yet, I don't have an ox to muzzle. And so because I don't have an ox to muzzle, does that then mean that the law doesn't apply to me? That principle is not applicable. No, it does not. And so there are, and Paul certainly didn't think so either. In fact, he talks about in that passage, how did God just mean this for oxen? No, he meant it for you and me. He meant it for all of us. And he goes on to further extrapolate principles from that law, which to us would seem like, oh, an old fashioned thing because we don't have oxen. And yet, so when we look at these sorts of things, we need to look at them analytically. We need to discuss them. We need to take them seriously. We need to, yes, apply them in their general equity and understand what that looks like. And many people have applied them incorrectly. Many people, however, have applied them correctly. I would use the United States of America, particularly at its founding, as an example of the general equity of God's judicial law being applied correctly. Now, all of this to say, there's a reason I'm not really pulling quotes from the first, 137 to 146 of this chapter, which is most of the chapter except for the last two pages, because much of it is something I've not really learned about, not really thought about or discussed. But additionally, they are things that I think we need to have a good discussion about before we entertain the idea of reinstituting them. For instance, burning, which is something mentioned here, or the devoting of a town, which basically means the destruction of that town, which we saw during the conquering of Joshua and several others in the Old Testament. Several other things mentioned here, removed from the altar, no hand shall touch him, capital confession. There's so many. How do you say them? What would you? Well, I don't even know how I would describe them, but instances in the Old Testament that bristle us in our modern sensibilities, right? So that can't be the only reason to discount them. We have to think them through. We do have to discuss them, and we have to have actual biblical reasons to discount them if we decide that's the biblical answer. But at the same time, given what I just outlined at the beginning of this episode, I don't think we can flat out say just because they did it this way as a punishment, that's exactly the way we have to do it. And this brought up a conversation too about stoning itself. Do we have to publicly stone people? Is that the only is that the only form of punishment for murder? And Jacob and I were discussing, well, no, they deserve the death penalty. But we think that there are other ways to get across what was being done there in the same manner, in a more modern way, right? So I think this is a conversation we need to have. I would, at this moment, not be someone who would say, yes, public burnings should be brought back. But, of course, we need to study them. We need to actually make decisions that are not just based on our own experiences and based on our own sensibilities, but actually based on the Bible. So this is something I'd like to discuss. But so I am going to move past those for now, just because there's so much confusion. And we've been talking the last couple, 2 weeks, really, about the last four chapters in this book, four or five chapters. And ultimately, we disagree with more in those chapters than we agree with. But the beginning part of this book was just phenomenal, right? So we highly recommend still checking out this book, even if it's just for the first couple of chapters, if it's for half the book, right? The last few, and we were warned, the last few are obviously highly controversial matters and things we need to discuss and things we're not actually even ready to discuss, unfortunately, but we should be, and we need to discuss these things. But as a church, we are unfortunately lacking in the discernment department to be able to accurately, I believe, discern these passages. So I will move, unless Jake, you had something you wanted to talk about regarding that before I moved.
Not entirely much. I would say for this very fact of the burning and all of that, not necessarily the desecration of towns or dedication of towns, as you said. I don't necessarily have an opinion on that. That's something that still has to be formulated and studied on my end. But for something like the burning and stoning, I would say that taking those in their general equity, we would have to say that yes, you know, you do, for someone who commits murder or someone who commits a capital offense, should be put to death, should receive the death penalty. Does that mean, and I understand the very point he brought this up in the book, and I totally agree with the point that this kind of has to be gruesome, right? He discussed multiple times the fact that gruesomeness of that death penalty makes it so that other people are unwilling to even touch or get close to that same crime. So there is a point, there is a reason why stoning and burning were used during that time. Are we then going to say, though, keeping in general equity, that those are the only things that we should use? I would say not. Mm. For instance, I bring up the electric chair. If anybody has watched Nefarious, you will understand that is a quite the very end, or close to the end, is one of the most not PG-13 parts of any of the movie. Yeah. So it can be something that is scary. Something that would be gruesome in that definition. Would we say that, well, we don't find electric chair in the Bible? Well, they didn't have electric then. So
Yeah, and again, this is a matter, and Terrell mentioned this at the beginning of the book. This is not an exciting matter. This is a matter of a heinous act has been committed.
Yeah.
Because there are many people who would think of that, you know, think of stoning and burning and the electric chair and think, oh my goodness, this is inhumane. This is horrible. How could you do this? Well, so is locking people up in cages like animals, but that's a different story. We've talked about that. What did these people do? Murdered someone else. They took someone else's life, slaughtered them, slaughtered the image of God, the Imago Dei. This is not a light matter, and this is not something that we lightly enter into, right? Mm-hmm. The death penalty has to be on the witness of two or three witnesses. And if they're wrong, they're lying, they face the death penalty. But this is serious. Everyone involved in the death penalty needs to take it seriously. Right? So this is not a fun topic, but it's something we are sorely lacking today. And it brings up a much broader conversation. When we are discussing the death penalty, we are discussing what it looks like for a people to love their neighbor so much that the blood of their neighbor being spilled means so much to them. This is what God said numerous times in the Bible. The blood of Abel cries to me from the cries to me from the dirt. The blood of your brother cries to me. The blood shed from someone made in the image of God pollutes the land. And that is a principle that Mr. Terrell lays out really, really well. And because of that, we need to take it seriously. Now, the other thing we need to discuss, and we discussed last week, is the blood of the murder of innocents. 60 million plus, I mean, probably closer to 80 million by now, babies murdered since the 60s, 70s. That blood still pollutes our land today.
Mm-hmm.
And that is an even further example of this. We want to know why we're facing the corruption we are, why our country's falling apart at the seams. That's why 60 plus million Imago Dei people, babies, innocents, people who couldn't defend themselves, slaughtered. That does not bring prosperity to a people.
Yeah, God may be merciful, but he's also just. And that justice has to be met. That's why we see, that's why God couldn't just say, oh, well, I forgive all of Israel for what they did. No, he needed to send his son. That justice needed to be met.
Mm.
His son had to die for those sins and those atrocities that Israel did to be just, to be justified.
Yep. But the Bible says it pleased God to pour out his wrath on him. Yeah. Yep. Sorry, we'll cut you off.
No, that was it.
Yeah. So all that to say, as we are nearing the end of this book, there are so many good principles that we have learned, we have derived from this book. We obviously encourage you, if you haven't grabbed a copy, to grab your own copy, but do be prepared the last couple of chapters, you know, and we've outlined it here, our disagreements with it. We think these are good conversations to have. These are necessary conversations to have. The questions that Terrell raises here are questions that we should have the answers to, but I think we've unfortunately lost the answers to. And we need to get those answers back if we're ever to be people who can be even remotely responsible for a nation and understanding true justice and morality on a civil governmental level. These are very important questions to raise. So I don't want to discount any of those as not important or trivial or just flat out disagree, just throw them away, right? None of that. But I do want to move into a quote on page 147. He was talking about spiritual versus physical. It's a very interesting point that he makes here. And then it's really just a paragraph and then he moves on. But I figured it was worth commenting on, at least just a little bit. He says, quote, "In the beginning, God made a perfect world, a shadow of heaven. Heaven and earth met and overlapped as perfectly as possible. Man's sin broke the world and made it no longer an accurate shadow of heaven. We think that what we can see and touch is what's real. God says otherwise. The things that are able to be seen and touched are temporary and will fade with time." I might take issue with that particular part, but that's okay. The unseen things are immovable and last forever. The heavenly things, the spiritual things, these are what are real. Okay. One day, heaven and earth will be completely reunited. The process is happening right now. I think that makes a lot of sense. I'd love to ask him what he meant by those two sentences in there. Things that we are able to see, that are able to be seen and touched, are temporary and will fade with time. The heavenly things, the spiritual things, these are what are real. Because he seems to kind of discount that a little bit with his last sentence. One day heaven and earth will be completely reunited. actually, this is the last sentence. The process is happening right now. I totally agree with that. The ultimate goal is to get back to the garden, get back to the way God originally intended creation to be created, right, to exist. And so everything we're doing and seeing around is a restoring back to that. But I think saying things like the things that are able to be seen and touched are temporary and will fade with time tends to lead to more ethereal theology and Gnostic-ish theology. So I don't know. It's a small thing. It's just one sentence or two sentences, but I was a little confused because he seems to say the opposite in a second. So
yeah,
I don't know. Your take, Jake?
I understand what you mean. Like, it's so much being in those, well, in those churches before you moved out to Moscow, being in those situations where, you know, these are what people say when they mean just spiritual, when, oh, heaven is our home, then that's where we always want to be and that's where we should be. It's no,
right.
Heaven is a temporary resting, a temporary place.
Yeah, it is glorious,
yes, but
yeah,
and not to say that that's exactly what he's saying. It's just those what he's saying could tend towards that.
Yeah, yep, for sure. And so finally, we get to the end of the chapter, and he's talking about. He says, "Don't modify the law. Don't modify the law." And I'll just read, let's see, last paragraph. It's really short on this page, 148, quote, "We do still have the instructions given to the Levites. This is for a purpose. The temple and sacrifices are shadows so that we may come to know the true spiritual reality of how to serve God and one another." Very true. That's, again, the general equity, right? We have these laws for a reason. 1 Corinthians 10:6 gives us, I think, the reason. It says, quote, "Now these things took place as examples for us, that we might not desire evil as they did." And this was talking about Israel's history. Why are we told all the things about the genealogies of Israel and the story of Moses and the story of all these prophets and people and the country, the nation of Israel? Why are we given all these things? Well, 1 Corinthians 10 tells us that we're given these things as examples of what not to do, right? That we might not desire evil as they did. And so their warnings, they're meant to instruct us. And of course, always remembering what the psalmist says, "Thy law is perfect, reviving the soul." That is the quintessential reminder that God's law is not something we hate or despise or run from or think is somehow evil or somehow is not something we should be reading about now that we're in the new covenant. It's very much something that we should learn from, and especially something that we should be discussing how to apply today, which is how we got the nation that we had for as long as we had it, was by people doing just that. Pastors preaching on the law, people talking about it, commentaries being written, books being written, newspapers being published, things being spread far and wide about the glories of God's law. And that's where you get to a point where people over in England can say, "The colonies have run off with a Presbyterian minister." Right? Because the colonies understood the glories of God's law. And until we get that back, until that's our desire once again, true justice is unattainable. Any attempt at true justice that we try to conjure up is going to be a band-aid. I think I was talking to, our dad actually this week, and we were talking about Trump. And we were talking about how kind of America is this sinking Titanic with a massive iceberg hole in it. Just, you know, 12 by 12 foot massive hole, right? And Trump, as a solution, is like us. I initially said it's like us trying to put a strip of duct tape on it, right? Or patch the hole with duct tape. And then I was like, no, actually, it's more like us trying to use scotch tape, right? That's fallen on the floor and barely sticks anymore. You know, it's good luck, you know, like why? I mean, what good will this do? And that's us when trying to find justice apart from God's law.
To add to the analogy, when we have a patch, a big enough piece of metal to patch the ship, we have the piece of patch to patch the ship right on the ship. Mm. We have the tools, have the men, we have the people to fix it. We could fix it. We just don't want to.
Well, I think I would say at this point, continuing the analogy, if I were to continue it, I would say we as the church are still trying to figure out how the heck to light our torch. we're struggling with this. We don't know how to light the torch. We're trying to look all over the place. We can't find the metal. We're stumbling all over the place. Some people are like, "Hey guys, I found it." And they're trying to lift it up, but they don't have enough people. Like we're not cohesive. Now we're still trying generally. I would say even the people that are standing there, you know, trying to light the torch and failing miserably, you know, cause they're standing in a puddle and they're trying to do it underwater. It's like, you know, I would say they're still at least trying. Not doing much good, but they're trying. So we have lots of those evangelifish people. But we need to study the law of God. We need to know these things. We need to have these conversations. And that's why I can still recommend this book, even though I disagree with a large chunk of it. Because the conversations Mr. Terrell provokes, which is what this was about, we've been saying from the beginning, that was his motivation, they are good conversations that we need to have right now. Any final thoughts, Jake, before we wrap up?
Nope.
Cool. Well, thank you all so much. We appreciate you watching us, listening to us, etc., etc. Please follow us on all our social media platforms. We're on YouTube for now, so you could follow us there. I do say for now for a reason, so you know, good luck. Have a great weekend. Have a wonderful Lord's Day, and we will see you next Wednesday when we're back to talk about current events once again from a biblical perspective. Also, by the way, you're going to want to hype up next Friday's episode because we're having Mr. Terrell on, and that's going to be quite the episode. But we will see you then, and again, have a wonderful Lord's Day, and we'll see you next Wednesday.
And remember, everyone, in all that you do, do it as unto the Lord.